I'm Samantha Goldman, and you're listening to the Food Explorers Podcast. As a parent, I know you dream of your child having a happy and healthy relationship with food. But I also know how exhausting and confusing it can be when your child just won't eat. In my background as an occupational and feeding therapist, I've helped hundreds of families, both in and out of the hospital, bring the magic back into mealtime and development. And I want to help you do that too. In this podcast, I give you the full scoop on the tools and tips you need to start helping your child confidently explore new foods while having fun. Please be advised that this is not medical or therapy advice and is just for general and informational knowledge. Let's get to the show. Sleep is one of our most basic needs. And when our kid isn't sleeping, not only are they impacted, but we are too. As a new mom, when this episode launches, you probably know that I am in the midst of living with very little sleep as we navigate newborn life. So I am in the thick of it. But here's the thing. Sensational kids often struggle with this well into their later years. They may have trouble falling asleep, needing a ton of support, or staying asleep through the night. And this turns into a tough spiral because they're tired and exhausted during the day, leading to more sensory and emotional challenges. So when Lindsay from Peaceful Sleep Secrets reached out to me last year about a collaboration, I just knew I needed to have her on the podcast. Lindsay is an autism and anxiety sleep coach, which is something I had never seen before. Here's what you need to know about Lindsay. Lindsay Clark is the founder of Peaceful Sleep Secrets. Based in Hampshire, England, she has over 20 years experience working with babies and younger children. It was after she realized the lack of support available for parents of autistic children and her eldest child on the pathway to diagnosis that she made the decision to train as an autism and anxiety sleep specialist. Her expert knowledge and firsthand experience means she is able to support families using gentle, bespoke approaches so that autistic children get lasting, long quality sleep. She has successfully helped improve sleep for hundreds of families worldwide through her one-to-one packages, group support programs, courses, and workshops. Lindsay also trains other sleep consultants and professionals to become certified autism sleep specialists. Her work has been published in several international magazines, including Autism Eye, Autism Parenting Magazine, and Autism Advocate Parenting Magazine, and she regularly works with autism charities. And I am absolutely obsessed with her neurodiversity affirming approach. As you'll see in this episode, she puts such an emphasis on supporting the needs of each individual child. If your sensational child struggles with sleep, this is not an episode you want to miss. I know you and your little are desperate for a good night's sleep. And don't you worry, I've got all the notes over on my website for you. So if you're busy on the go and want to go back later for reminders, you'll find that at www.drsamgoldman.com/blog. Let's get to it. Hey, Lindsay, I'm so excited to have you here today. I know so many of our parents have big, big questions surrounding sleep. So this is going to be such a good podcast.
Yeah, I'm so excited to be here. Like, I can't wait to give the parents, you know, as much support as possible. Hopefully lots of tips and things today that are going to get their children sleeping a lot better.
Tips. I know everybody is excited to hear those. But before we jump right in, can you tell us a little bit about you and who you are?
Yeah, sure. So my name's Lindsay Clark. I'm an autism and anxiety sleep specialist. And my background is in education. So I used to be a teacher. I taught a kind of primary age children for about 20 years before I went into sleep consulting. And I'm also a mum of two. So I've got two little ones of my own. They're currently 6 and almost 4. My partner is actually neurodivergent. My daughter is currently being assessed. She's the eldest of the two, so she's 6. It takes a long time here in the UK to get a diagnosis. So we're going through that process at the moment with her. So that's kind of a bit about my background, really.
Oh, man. So you're going through the whole process right now. How long did it take you to kind of get into all of that over there?
So we had kind of suspicion. She showed some traits, you know, as a toddler. that we thought, you know, maybe she's autistic, but it wasn't really, you know, nursery and preschool never brought anything up. It wasn't until she started school. And it was the social and communication aspect. And like emotionally, she is not where her peers are. So that was quite evident as soon as she started school. She's one of the oldest in the year, so she was sort of almost five. And yeah, they pretty much said straight away, we feel like there is some issues here, and put some support in place, but actually we want to get some further advice. So they got specialist teachers in to observe her, and they agreed, and then we've been put through the process. But it's kind of, we were told it's about a year to 2 years. We're nearly a year in. So
wow, yeah,
that's just to get the like in-person assessment. So we've done like you have online ones first, so we've done those. We're waiting for the in-person ones, basically.
That is a long process. Here, if we wait like 6 weeks, I feel like we're kind of like, oh, 6 weeks feels so long.
Really? Oh no, this yeah, it can take like 2 to 3 years as well here. Like, yeah. So
wow. And so why sleep? Is sleep something that you guys were experiencing at home, sleep challenges? How did you go from being a primary school teacher over to sleep?
Yeah, very much so. My children were atrocious sleepers as babies, as in they would not be put down. And like as newborns, that is normal. It's normal for a baby to want to be close to you. But there was, even as they got a bit older, they weren't sleeping for any more than like anything between 10 minutes and an hour, maybe. And we weren't getting any sleep at all. And so I got help with support with my own children. And it just transformed everything. And it made me become more interested in the area. After having my son, like teaching is not the most flexible career. Like, you know, my daughter was going to be starting school in a couple of years' time. There's just, it's long. It's not always what people think. It's quite long days. You have work to do in the evening, work to do on your days off as well. So I always knew I wanted to do something more flexible. So after having my son, I thought, I'm going to retrain. It was lockdown, and I thought, I'm going to retrain, do something different. And that's when I went into sleep. You know, I'd already experienced myself what a difference it makes. And it really did transform my experience as, you know, as a mother, having better sleep, and for my children as well. So that's how I became more interested in that area, really.
I think sleep is like one of our absolute most basic needs. And when that's disrupted, I mean, both for kids and for us, it's really hard to go through the day feeling good.
Yeah, I think it makes everything else that's already like a challenge is 10 times harder when you have not had sleep. If you can get sleep, it just makes everything else feel a bit easier, doesn't it? Particularly if you have got, you know, a child that's got other challenges as well. Like as a parent, I know that even now, if my sleep is disrupted, like my little boy had chickenpox the other week and we had a week of disrupted sleep, I just am more irritable. You just haven't got the patience, and same for them as well. Like I can tell when they've had a bad night's sleep. So, and I think people forget, you're constantly told as a parent, like, oh, expect no sleep. And it's kind of a bit of a joke, isn't it? But actually it makes it seem like it's not a necessity when actually it is. It's not a luxury to want some sleep. Yeah, it's so important. And I know everyone has different tolerance levels too, but my tolerance is probably quite low and I need sleep, but I definitely, it's so important, I think.
Especially when we're talking about kids who have sensory challenges, when they already are not getting sleep, that gives their sensory system less room to tolerate other things.
Oh yeah. Yeah. 100%. Like sleep will, you know, heighten those sensory sensitivities, and it can make behavior more challenging as well, because when you're more irritable, yeah, you are less patient, aren't you? And it's the same for children. So it can enhance those challenges any child faces if they're not getting the rest that they need.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually something that interested me so much when you had first reached out to connect. Was I was like, ooh, autism and anxiety. I hadn't really seen anybody focusing specifically on those areas when it came to sleep. So can you tell us a little bit about what makes that area different versus, you know, why they might have different challenges sleeping versus somebody without those diagnoses?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the reasons for issues in sleep are often different when a child is neurodivergent. You know, in neurotypical children, it's often that they just don't know how to fall asleep independently or are reliant on a parent to do something, or the sleep hygiene isn't quite there. In neurodivergent children, the issues are often caused by something different. It can be to do with the way the brain is wired. It can affect the circadian rhythm. That autistic children are known to produce lower levels in melatonin, for example. So that means that they find it harder to fall asleep and stay asleep. So when you look at like generic kind of sleep training and what the advice is generally out there, like if you were just to Google, you know, I want my child to sleep better or help my child sleep better, you're going to get those generic techniques and methods and things. That's not going to work with a neurodivergent child because the root cause is different. And it's not usually just because they can't fall asleep alone. There's normally a deeper issue than that. Like I said, the melatonin can play a part. Obviously, that's something that, you know, melatonin is produced naturally in the body. So when the levels are lower, it just is going to be harder for them to fall asleep, like I said, and often stay asleep as well. The circadian rhythm as well, which I already mentioned, is often not programmed in the same way or like the typical way we'd expect, which means the body clock can be like out of sync, which is where you'll often get really late nights and then they want to sleep in the morning. My own daughter does that. Or like an awake period in the night, like they're wide awake, like they should be in a different time zone. So those things require specific different intervention than perhaps, you know, a neurotypical child might need. And obviously the two things overlap there. You know, there are elements that I would use from my toolkit, you know, with neurotypical children, neurodivergent children, but actually it's a lot of a deeper issue, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. I have seen so many autistic children struggle so much, like you said, with that falling asleep, that staying asleep, that waking up in the middle of the night and they are wired and ready to go.
Yeah. And they're the most typical issues that I see. Really late bedtimes, frequent waking or long periods of awake time, or children that wake up super early in the morning. I'm not just talking 5 o'clock. I'm talking 2, 3, 4 a.m. and not going back to sleep. The day starts then. That's so hard for families. But it is common in autism and in neurodivergence. So it's, if you know, the parents are listening, you're not alone. It is common. It's nothing you've done, nothing at all.
Well, let's dive in right there. Tell us more. What can you do when it starts those late nights?
Yeah, I mean, I've got three of my main tips here I thought I'd share today. One of them is to look at the sensory issues and sensory sensitivities. Look at your bedtime routine and think about, you know, if you know your child is particularly sensitive to something like teeth brushing, hair brushing, like obviously we need to do those activities, but doing them, or those tasks, I should say, but doing them not so they're not right before bedtime, rearranging your bedtime routine so that those things are maybe when they get in from school or get in from nursery. It's not ideal, but it's going to be better for them than not doing it, or better for them than doing it really close to bedtime. Something as simple as that, if your child has a sensitivity to it, can add hours onto bedtime. I've seen it happen where just a teeth brush before bedtime has added 2 hours because the child is so kind of triggered by it. The other thing is the environment as well. You know, often rooms are very cluttered, or we have night lights or light projectors, things like that. Like, you really need to take each individual child's sensitivities into account when looking at their bedroom as well, like removing clutter, removing toys if need be. Thinking about the lighting. Is there any smells that's annoying them, like the fabric that they've got on their bed? So all those sensory things are definitely things we need to look at and really pick apart. Like, it can seem like a small thing, but it can have a big impact. So that's kind of one of my tips. Is that all making sense?
Oh, I love that. Because from an OT perspective, we're always talking, we call it the arousal system in OT. Yeah. And any of those things that might be triggering, it is alerting, right? Like, our body is on high alert now. Like, we are like, oh no, this brushing my teeth, it doesn't feel good. And you're amped up. So yeah, it's hard to go to sleep after that. So I love that, like tuning into what your child's triggers are, and maybe just shifting it a couple hours earlier. That makes so much sense.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes those little tweaks are actually the thing that can make the biggest difference. If you make a few little tweaks and they all help, then that can help with the bedtime. And the other, like my second tip was looking at anxiety as well. You've just kind of touched on that anyway. Like if their system is alerted, then that triggers anxiety. If a child is anxious, if anybody is anxious about something, you are not going to be able to sleep. I know that if I'm worried about something, I can't get to sleep. Your brain is worrying, isn't it? And children can't always communicate what that is. They don't even know themselves sometimes, the thing that's triggered them or made them anxious. But, you know, not 8 out of 10 children that are neurodivergent, usually suffer with anxiety as well. And even if it's not clear what it is necessarily. So it really is about, you know, digging deep again, finding out what is causing that anxiety. It could be something that happened much earlier in the day, or things that have mounted up during the day, not just at bedtime. Like literally need to look at the kind of 7 till 7, or the 7 in the morning till 7 in the evening as well, not just 7 till 7 at night, to find out what's happening, what's making them anxious, and then trying to kind of put things in place to lower that anxiety and to kind of counterbalance it, so that the anxiety is brought down. Otherwise, it's going to be its highest at bedtime, and then there's going to be no switching off. Or they'll switch off at bedtime because they're exhausted, and then those anxieties, when they rouse in the night, come to the surface, and then you've got a very awake, alert child. So that can happen too.
Do you have any favorite things that you turn to usually for helping calm them back down or helping relieve some of that before bed?
I mean, it depends on the age of the child and the understanding. Obviously, every child I work with is completely different. Often things like social stories and teaching them techniques with older children is quite good. Doing things like introducing anything that helps them regulate, really. And this was going to be my third tip. Sometimes we have to kind of ditch what you're told about what like the perfect bedtime routine looks like. For some children, the only thing that regulates them, and this is just an example, is having a bit of screen time, having a bit of, you know, watching the iPad or something like that. Sometimes 10 minutes on an iPad, it brings the anxiety down. Then I would suggest you do include that, maybe not as part of the bedtime routine, but like early evening, letting them have that bit of time. You know, we're always told avoid screens, aren't we? And yes, screens aren't great for sleep, but actually just having that bit of regulation time to bring down the anxiety for some children will help them. Or if it's that your child loves jumping on the trampoline and that really helps them regulate, you know, anything that's going to counterbalance that anxiety is going to help. So I would structure that in before, you know, when they get in from, if they're at childcare or, you know, like I said, afternoon time.
I actually love that, especially because the autistic community has kind of come out recently and said like screen time can be helpful for us. And I personally feel that too. For me, when it comes to sleep, if I don't have like just 30 minutes of couch time with my husband to sit and watch TV, when I go to bed, I am amped up. I don't know why, but it's the one time my brain really turns off, right?
Yeah, I know. And if you think about it, that's what we generally do to relax, isn't it? I know of an evening, I want to put my feet up, watch some Netflix or whatever, and, you know, relax to something that I enjoy. And I think, you know, sometimes withholding that from a child can make them more anxious as well. So it does need to be obviously limited and monitored and things like that. But I know that my daughter, when she gets in from school, we don't do any after school clubs. She is done. Like she doesn't want to do anything. She wouldn't cope with doing anything else or even a longer day doing anything. She gets in, you know, watches a bit of TV. We do some games and things, and she needs that time to wind down. If we do different things or we go somewhere or do something, it can make her much later to bed. So yeah, it's I wouldn't follow like I said, the perfect bedtime routine, that kind of advice that you are always told. Don't worry about breaking it if it's right for your child.
I love that. It is so important to look at each specific kid and what their personal needs are, because every single kid is really so different.
Yeah.
So we did kind of touch on kids waking up in the middle of the night and What do you kind of recommend when that's happening a lot for somebody? What are some of those strategies? Is it more of what we just talked about, like the things setting up earlier in the day? Or are there things you could do in the moment?
Yeah, I mean, some of those things will definitely help. Making sure those sensory needs are met. Like, again, it's looking at the whole day as a whole. And sometimes children need a lot of, or some children need a lot of sensory breaks. Like, one of the biggest things I see that has an impact on sleep is them not having enough like big movement activities. So adding more of that in can really help. And often as well, the child's behavior during the night can give us a clue as to what they're needing more of. So often I will work with children who are stimming a lot in the night or jumping around or shouting, things like that. And obviously no one in the house can sleep when that's going on. So actually sometimes that gives us a clue as to what they need more of in the day. And just adding in like a few 5 minute breaks where they can have, you know, like it's time to jump on the trampoline or run around or whatever it may be, swing it, you know, it can really help with the sleep at nighttime. So that's a common one I see. And giving children, like older children, those independent skills, like I mentioned earlier, like things like the breathing activities, so that they have strategies themselves to get back to sleep, often helps too. One thing that I don't usually suggest is doing like rewards and things like that. Like often people want to give rewards, but sometimes the pressure of a reward makes it worse. Like the anxiety of thinking, am I going to get it? Am I going to not? They become very focused on that and then they can't sleep as well. So I tend to steer away from rewards when it is neurodivergent children. But certainly looking at all those things, the anxiety, the sensory needs, looking at behavior. Sometimes when it is anxiety, it can end up becoming a habit. Like, you know, they wake nervous, want a parent in the room, they can't quite say why. So again, it's just about making gentle changes and encouraging that independence. But actually I wouldn't ever suggest doing anything like drastic, leaving them, just telling them to go back to bed if they're upset and anxious. They're going to need those strategies.
Yeah, it definitely reminds me too of, for like some of the adult tips, they say when you wake up in the middle of the night, not to sit there and just like think about going back to bed, right? The pressure of that. So I could understand how the pressure of a reward or something like that might be really challenging. It would get them more awake and worried.
Yeah, or it can end up causing, if they don't get it, can end up causing like more anxiety, which makes it worse. So that's why I tend to kind of stay away from those really.
Yeah. So something else that a lot of my parents talk about is having to be physically in the room as their child falls asleep. And I definitely have my OT perspective on this, but I'm excited to hear kind of your perspective on it. A lot of times they need to be like physically sitting there, holding them, patting them, and it can go on for hours to help them fall asleep. Any tips with improving kind of independence in going to sleep?
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on why the child needs the parent there as well. Like you do have to think about that. Usually it is linked to some kind of anxiety, some kind of like separation or something that's happened during the day that has caused them that anxiety. And again, the strategies will depend on the child and their age and their understanding too. There are lots of like simple things you can do to improve independence. Using visual aids is one of those that can, and there are lots of different bedtime visual aids that you can get, but that will help promote independence because your child can be part of forming those visual aids and putting them together and like designing a bedtime routine and things like that, doing role play of what you're expecting so that they know what to expect at bedtime and making changes really gradually. The other thing with doing like the visual aids and role play is neurodivergent children take longer to process things, particularly if it is auditory. So having the visual, having done it, having warning of what's going to happen is going to help when you do try and make any tweaks and changes. And like I said, I would just make those changes very gently and in small steps, nothing drastic, because that's probably going to have an adverse effect. Other things people can do are things like social stories, where the story is about the child and what's going to happen to them. So it's much more personal. Inc. often like things like encouraging attachment to a toy or giving them like an item for parents. I did work with a little boy once who was three, and we got a cushion made of mum's face. And he like loved it. And then he started sleeping so much better. He wasn't diagnosed like autistic, but he was very highly anxious. And just introducing that just helped him sleep a bit better. And eventually we were able to move mum was on a mattress next to him all night, actually. And eventually we were able to move her out of the room. So there's some like simple things. There are like other sort of tricks you can use. There's one called the ribbon trick. I don't know if have you heard of this?
No.
I'll explain it. So with the ribbon trick, if you've got a child who wants to be kind of attached or touched all the time, or you right there, what you can do is they want their connection with you still. And I think they feel like when you're going to leave, obviously they can't see you anymore, but they feel like the connection's kind of broken, although we know it's not. And obviously bedtime is a goodbye, isn't it? It's the longest time they're going to be away from you. So that's why a lot of children get anxious about it. They know they're not going to see you till morning. The longest time they're going to be away from you. So with the ribbon trick, what you do is it's an idea to say they still feel connected to you. So you get a ribbon, the child holds one end and you hold the other end, but first of all, right next to them. So you start right next to their bed. And then gradually each night you move away, but still holding onto the ribbon. So you're still connected. And obviously once the child is asleep, you need to remove it. So there's no danger at risk. But eventually then obviously you can move out of the room and say, I'm just outside the door, hold on to the ribbon. And then eventually you can stop holding the ribbon. So for some children that are highly anxious, that technique works really well in, you know, supporting them just to be a bit more independent too. It takes time, but like anything, every small step forward is still a step forward. And sometimes these things do take a bit of time, but it's worth it in the end.
Oh, that's so sweet. I love that. I love the connection there, that it's still there. They're learning it's still there. Even if you're a little bit farther away, you're still there.
Yeah, exactly. So something simple, but it can work really well in the right circumstances.
So it does sound like everything you do is super personalized. What does it look like when somebody does kind of book with you? Are you there overnight with them? Are you there for like the bedtime? How does it work?
No, I'm not. I think that would probably throw the child off, having a stranger in the house at bedtime. Probably make them worse. No, so what I do is basically when a family sign up to work with me, I do like a thorough assessment of sleep. Well, first of all, I talk to them on the phone. I find out all about their child, what their kind of triggers are, what their issues are, any sensitivities, what the child likes. So I get to know the child as much as I can through the parent. And then they complete some assessments for me that tell me everything I need to know, basically. And then I do a personalized plan for each child. So I do look at things like anxiety and sensory sensitivities, environment, what's happening at bedtime, and what sleep methods we kind of need to put in place to maybe promote independence if the child isn't independent. It's all based on the parents' goals as well, you know, what they want to achieve. And then, yeah, we have like a consultation over Zoom where we talk it all through. We discuss what things we need to tweak or change and what the family feel comfortable doing. We're going to do first, what we're going to do next. So it is very much, I come up with the plan, but I do talk to parents because ultimately they know their child best. And I talk them through and kind of finalize it with them. And we discuss what we're going to put in place and what the next steps are and things. And then I support them for usually between like 2 and 4 weeks with implementing any changes. We like check in, phone calls, messages, emails, whatever the family feel most comfortable with, really. So the support is there as and when they need it.
Pretty their quick.
Track. Yeah, I mean, not all children are exactly where they want to be, like the end of 2 weeks, say, but the thing is the parents have the tools and the knowledge, and we've made sure we've tweaked everything so we know everything is on track. And they just need to continue doing it. Like the consistency is the thing that's going to get the results in the end. So yeah, often children do start like sleeping through and we see improvement in the 2 weeks, but realistically it can take a couple of months for things to fully come together.
So I do want to talk about this week's email that you sent out, because I thought it was a really good one. You kind of pointed out that there is no real regulations when it comes to kind of the sleep industry. And, you know, that's challenging because when you're trying to pick somebody out to help you, you want to make sure they know what they're talking about. What do you recommend for parents? Like what to look at, how to know they're going in the right direction with somebody?
It is difficult because the sleep industry isn't regulated, which is a shame because someone like me, if it was regulated, I'd be the first to be signing up and getting that, you know, whatever it is they brought out. You know, I'd absolutely want to have that. And it really is going to be about looking at the sleep consultant. If you're thinking of working with somebody, checking that their values align with yours and your parenting style, that you feel comfortable with what their methods might be. Like nobody's a sleep consultant, if you contact them and say, you know, what kind of methods do you use? What, you know, and ask them those questions like, you know, I want to go down the gentler route or I want things as quick as possible. You know, you need to make sure that you're aligned in what, you know, in your thoughts about sleep and parenting. So I would definitely go on to like their Instagram page, make sure you've seen them talking or something so you can get a gist that you would get on with them and that you're a good fit to work with each other, because you know you are going to have to be honest with them, feel like you can speak to them, that they're going to listen to you because you do know your child best. So things like that are really important. And you know, you can always ask like who did you train with as well. The thing is, there are sleep courses that are like one day courses that you can just do and then you can call yourself a sleep consultant. I didn't do that, by the way. But yeah, even just asking them like, who did you train with? How did you get into this? What experience have you got? I know that I wouldn't be offended by being asked that.
Are there specific ones that you recommend people look out for? That's like, if somebody trained at this place, you know, it's like a really kind of research-based, really good.
I mean, I work with a lot of different, I wouldn't like to say, because I work with a lot of different ones and I wouldn't want to offend anyone by not mentioning them, because through my autism role, I work with a lot of the different providers, but obviously I haven't trained with them. I've only trained with one myself. So it's tricky for me to comment, I'm afraid.
Okay. No, I just was wondering because I don't know any of the regulations about sleep. Well, this was so helpful. We did talk about so much though. So if there is one thing that parents should leave today kind of thinking or somewhere that you think would be a good place for them to start, what would it be?
So my like top bit of advice would be some of the things I've mentioned already, really. Number one, actually, is just because if you have a neurodivergent child and they're not sleeping, it doesn't mean that you need to accept sleepless nights. Often when parents go to healthcare professionals like doctors, or we have healthcare visitors here, they will just give you the generic advice and say autistic children don't sleep, or you just need to put up with it. Or they'll just suggest giving melatonin, which isn't the long-term answer. And you don't need to just put up with it. There are strategies and there are things you can put in place to fix it. Like your child will be able to sleep well. It's just about working with their unique needs. I would definitely be focusing on like the sensory, the anxiety, and ditching that perfect bedtime routine that we talked about, and reminding yourself that actually that small step forward, even a small change you make, if it does something positive, then it's still a step towards that big end goal, and that's a good thing.
Oh, that was such an amazing answer. I love that. So where can our audience find you? Because I know they are going to be dying to keep connecting.
Oh yeah, of course. And I'd love to have them. So my Instagram page is Autism and Anxiety Sleep Coach. It's got the all like underscores between the words. And on my website, I've got a specific section for like autism and anxiety. And my website is peacefulsleepsecrets.com. And there's also a couple of free eBooks you can download on there as well. So if anyone wants to head over there, you'll be able to see them. And obviously you can email me, lindsay@peacefulsleepsecrets.com.
And I will link this all in the show notes so everybody can go find that easily and connect with you.
That's great. Yeah. And, you know, I'm always happy to have a chat. So if anyone's ever got a question, feel free to like DM me, email me. I will always get back to you, or, you know, point you to a blog post or, you know, my eBooks, things like that. But I always do my best to help anyone that does message me.
Lindsay, thank you so much for being here. This was so much fun.
Yeah, you too. Thank you for having me. It's been lovely.
Thank you for listening to the Food Explorers Podcast, a podcast about helping your child learn to become a confident and happy eater. If you love this episode, please make sure to share it with a friend, subscribe, or leave a review wherever you are listening. This helps parents just like you find this podcast and start bringing the magic back into mealtime. Thanks again for joining me today, and I'll see you next time.